Hello, my lovely patrons. What you are about to listen to is a bunch of deleted scenes, cuts, if you will, from the first episode of our new deep dive series of Doing It. So the first episode was all about sex therapy, and that is out now and you can listen to it. And there is, of course, the ad-free version of that for patrons, so you guys can listen to that version. And essentially, for the interviews, we recorded for about an hour and a half with each guest individually. And there are at least three main voices in each episode. And the final episodes are under an hour. So obviously, there is a lot that we had to cut. And I wanted to share that content with you guys so that you could get a flavor of the full interviews and all of the other brilliant things that our guests had to say. So what you're about to hear are deleted scenes from the interviews with Silva Neves, Jessica Parker, and Emma Louise Boynton. So I hope you enjoy them. And I hope you enjoyed the main episode. Of course, please let me know what you think. And here you go. Lots of sporadic cuts and clips. Yay.
Genuinely, when I first had Penetrative Sex, my reference point, the only thing I knew to draw on, was Marissa having sex with Ryan in the OC. I had no idea what to do. I didn't know how to communicate. I didn't know how to say anything. I just thought, okay, Marissa got on top and she moved around. It was my only reference point. That is appalling. And I couldn't communicate. I didn't know how to say this hurts, or I don't like this, or could we, like, I had no language to talk about sex. Dr. Karen Gurney, who's a brilliant sex therapist, I interviewed her once and she said to me, a lot of people that come into her sex therapy room don't actually need sex therapy because the issues that they are facing are pretty simple, but it's just because we don't talk about sex publicly. So I think for a lot of people that invariably leads to lots of issues around sex. There's anxiety issues, sexual dysfunction issues, etc.
Why do you think it's important for sex therapists to get that extra special training to be able to best serve marginalized groups?
I think it's important for sex therapists to get specialized training and keep getting specialized training for marginalized groups, say, for example, for LGBTQ people, gender diverse people, or neurodiverse people, or sex workers, and this, you know, all the marginalized populations, basically, simply because it's impossible to know everything. I work with a lot of clients who have a very different identity from mine and very different erotic mind than mine, and I can work very well with them because I trained properly and keep learning and keep updating my knowledge in the areas that are with identities that are different from mine.
When do you think it's most beneficial for someone to come to sex therapy solo versus if it's important for them to come as a couple?
Sex therapy can be accessed both as a solo person or as a couple or as part of polycures if you're in multiple relationships. We don't really know at the beginning when people come in if therapists with their partners will be more beneficial than solo therapy. It really much depends if people say that they have a sexual problem that's mostly occurring with their partner, but not in solo sex. So what is the problem here? Sometimes the problem could be that actually both of them never really talked about their sex life, or they never really talked about their turn-ons, or they find it very difficult to approach the subject so that both of them can be in collaboration with having a better sex life. So in those cases, which is quite a frequent one, inviting the partner or inviting the partners might be really, really beneficial. You know, we tend to have sex with other people. And so if the other people are in the process, it's much easier. But sometimes it's best to be solo because some people may have some sexual problems because of childhood past trauma, or because they want to talk about their childhood. They want to talk about, you know, issues that they've had with their parents, for example, and they might not always want their partner to know about it, because some things can be really, really quite private. Some people might want to come because they worry about their pornography use, but they might not want their partner to know how much they watch pornography. That's when solo sex therapy could be beneficial.
I've got my train to countryside, and he's got this like really beautiful little house that feels very kind of spiritual. He's got like, you know, sheets on the ceiling and burning incense, and you kind of step into this cave of, yeah, sexual healing. And we'd had a call before, and he talked through his practice, and he'd said that it obviously it's not entirely sexual, but like there is a like sexual element. You can always say no, like it's all about being communicative, etc., etc. We set it up that like, it was very, very consent driven. He explained how he works, etc. So I went there, and it's you do a bit of like talking therapy first, and you explain your relationship to sex. I gave some the whole context. I'd done sex therapy. I've had some great experiences after. Then I've had some terrible sexual experiences more recently, which has kind of like knocked my confidence a bit and made me kind of question a lot of the stuff I learned and was feeling a bit out of whack with everything. And then he begins doing body work. So you lie on the floor and he begins to like move energy around your body. And I have to say, I am quite cynical about a lot of like spiritual woo-woo things, but actually found it quite amazing. And I think having someone just also touch your body in certain bits, be like, there are just certain points which would be really painful that you touch, and then the bits that would feel I'd want to cry, and then bits would make me laugh. It was a really powerful exercise to get me to really be present in my body. And the whole time he was asking me, does this feel good? How does this feel? Is this okay? Is this all right? So we were building up this line of communication that was helping me feel comfortable articulating how every bit of touch felt. So this kind of went on for, like, honestly, I think for a few hours. You kind of like lose track of time there. And then he goes down and he goes to your pelvis, and then he goes to your, and he's like, are you okay for me to do like internal body work? And I mean, I'd said at the beginning, I was on my periods. I'm going to need to go whip out my tampon. So he was like, buy a tampon. I go, a tampon in the bin. Like thinking like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. And then he does like internal, basically what he calls like a yoni massage. He's like pumping your cervix and like, and honestly, I'd gone in being like, I've not come all the way to the countryside outside of Lisbon to go away and had a back massage, like, absolutely not. And it was, and then ended up orgasming, and then we kind of lied there. He puts a blanket over you, so take a few moments, and got dressed, and then we sat together, and he gave me cookies and tea, and we talked about it. And it was such a bizarre experience, obviously, mainly because I was kept on thinking in my head, I was like, I can't believe this is this man's day today. This is wild. Like, what do you put on your LinkedIn? And it made me realize, like, and this is true, I think, of a lot of people who have sexual dysfunction. It oftentimes it's not an anatomical issue. It really is a psychological issue. I think what I found was it was kind of like the ideal sexual experience, in that there was like loads of communication. I'd really like sat in my body. I'd spent time building up the context in which my like desire, my sexual energy had been sent. So by the time it got to like the yoni work, I was like, my body was like on fire. And to me, it was a really stark reminder of the embodied nature of sex, which for me had become disembodied and theoretical because of sex talks.
Totally think there's definitely a time and place for talking therapy, but I find that sometimes, particularly when many of my clients who have come to me, they're like, right, I've done the talking thing for like all my life. And they recognize the fact that they're still in their heads, and there's an element that needs to get them back in their bodies. So sexological body work can help be a lot more practical than talk therapy in terms of relearning about themselves. And that's where the sexological body worker can actually support a person into actually being able to show them hands on or hands off to be able to see their own body in a new way. Whereas talk therapy is just based on, you know, talking about the processes. The sexological body work combined with actually talking about your felt emotions, your experiences, then combined with actually doing more somatic experiencing or pleasure mapping. So that's sort of more practical homework that you can take away and then use in your daily life straight away. The bodywork element can actually get people just like it's coming back to the basics, which we tend to complicate in our sexual lives. We're like, okay, we need all the things. We need like it to be dynamic and different and fun, which is fun. Definitely there's a time and place for that. But basic skin on skin, touching, breathing, coming back to our actual, the tangible sort of that tangible reference point where we can feel rather than being in our heads. I think that's the beauty of bodywork and how touch, bodywork, massage or dance, any sort of element of bodywork can actually bring us back to that center. All around in our heads, buzzing all around, just thinking, listening to podcasts like this, which is great, but we tend and looking at our phones or being in our heads and thinking constantly, even when we're going on walks, rather than somatically, so body experiencing and feeling, using all of our senses in the present moment.
Do you have like a 1 minute exercise that we could do right now that the people listening would be able to do along with us?
Yeah. Definitely. Full disclaimer, it's not my own. I don't know who brought, you know, it's a well-known one. But I think it's a good way to bring us back into your body. If you can't close your eyes, maybe you're driving or walking around, you know, have an element of allowing your body to be still, or some part of your body to be still. It could be your feet. It could just be placing your hand on your belly. And ideally, you can just close your eyes and just take a full bellied breath. And then just two more, so a nice, deeper, slower inhale. And full exhale. And then you can just open your eyes and just look around you and really use your eyes to notice something that shines out to you. It could be as mundane as your drink bottle. It could be a sparkling, shining droplet of water. But just see what your eyes are most attracted to now and really zone in on that thing that you can see. And then shift your awareness to your sense of smell. And even if there's not much around you to sort of smell, just really focus in on nothingness. Neutral smell. Maybe there's something that's not particularly nice, but just put your full focus on something that your sense of smell can really focus on. And take your focus to taste. So you might have just had your morning cup of coffee and it's a bit bitter, or maybe you haven't had anything for a while and there might be some remnants of what you had for dinner, or see if you can focus on anything within your taste buds. So full focus on your sense of taste. And then just come back to your body. Wiggle your toes on the ground. Or if you're seated, just wiggle your butt on the ground. Just get some grounding. Really get that nice sort of base foundation. Feel the weight of your bones, either on your feet or your hips. And take another nice deep breath and fully exhale into that strong base, that sort of grounding sense.
I can taste remnants of sour cream and onion Pringles in my mouth. Do you want to talk a little bit about like what we did and kind of, yeah, what did you think? What did we do together? How did that look? For context, for those listening, after having my baby by C-section, I was not expecting it, but I struggled with penetration in terms of that, like my vagina just kind of clenched up. And having had a C-section delivery, I wasn't expecting to have any issues with my vagina. I thought I was in the clear. And alas, that was not the case.
With me as a mum myself, I was like, right, what's the main thing that we need to, that you can support yourself with now? And it might be just doing, you know, having one moment of doing some, you know, presence touching of the areas that you wanted to work in. It could just be during the shower. It could just be after you're peeing, or whenever you're going to get those moments, we've got to be practical and realistic. It seems like the most intense season of your life, but this is just a season where, you know, your priorities are a bit wavy at the moment.
I think that doing the work with you was so useful. And actually, like, penetrative sex is now back on our sex menu.
Yay!
And yeah, the kind of techniques that you showed me, and also just kind of the information that I learned from the session that we did, like the mapping session of kind of learning about where the problem was, for lack of a better word. But then also kind of like the process of like pressing into it, but then holding steady.
So what we did with you, so one thing to note is that it's very common, particularly with C-sections, for women's vaginas to just sort of go in a little bit of a like holding pattern, because they've had all these, you know, lots of pelvic gymnastics have gone on with contractions and everything, sort of prepping, getting ready. So when the actual birth canal is all ready and then the baby sort of bypasses the canal through C-section, the muscles are still primed, you know, to do their marathon. So having lots of internal massage or mapping or holding afterwards is really key. And, you know, some women that I've done vaginal massage afterwards, just like you would a shoulder massage, you know, sort of going in gentle and then finding a few pressure points, holding, being still, breathing. I've had one very powerful client that, you know, almost had the rest of her contractions like a couple of years afterwards. It was a massive emotional release, and she had had a C-section and she was just feeling tight and not quite right all those years after. And it's almost like we completed the birthing process in a way. It was mind-blowing what the body can still hold on to, because basically I guess you've just done a bit of a handbrake on the vagina. They're like, okay, I'm ready, and then you do the C-section for whatever it is. So the vagina is still prepped or hasn't fully completed its mission that it was on board, that it's designed to do. So with pleasure mapping, so you had a specific quadrant on your vagina that was painful during penetration and you experienced it.
Yeah, like a stinging, like friction burn kind of feeling.
So we did some holding on the external vulva and it was all guided by you. So you were sat on the massage table. I had my gloved hands and lots of organic coconut oil. And we were doing some holding and warming. It can get a little bit tedious for some people, but it's also very empowering to give full agency for the vulva vagina owner to be able to say, okay, I'm ready for you to move now. Okay, and move. And deeper and stronger and softer. So what you are doing is basically guiding my fingers. I was suggesting, okay, now we're going to get closer to the perineum quadrant of your vagina. And then we're going to move. I said, we're going to move around to maybe 7 o'clock slowly with one finger one finger knuckle depth. And then you would tell me what sensations you were feeling. So it was either neutral, it was like, okay, that's fine, or it was like, oh no, that's edgy. So we didn't go over the edge when you started to have your sensations that weren't as comfortable, but we sort of scaled it back and moved closer to the edge. So your body could get online, you could breathe, you could get yourself sort of relaxed. Mm. So once your body relaxed, your brain then could breathe. And then we can, you know, notice the actual point. And most of the time, the pain or the edginess or scratchiness sort of had melted away. And when I talk about pain, I talk about, you know, a sort of a manageable, we're not pushing over the edge. We're just going to like, okay, that's a bit, I noticed that. So rather than just instantly pull away, we're just hanging out in that zone just to see if there's any lessening or what happens when we do notice and zone and have presence and send breath to that area. So it's quite a slow process and you can do this on any part of your body, but particularly with you, we wanted to focus on having the space for your body to let go of whatever it was holding on to. When we realized that there was no scar tissue or anything structurally so-called wrong, it was more of a holding of some form of sensation for whatever reason. I don't know if you have discovered the reason for that. You know, it's just is what it is.
I think one of the things that definitely resonated with me when we were working together and also in what you were just saying then was that I do brace myself. That's just something that clearly has just been in my body for a long time of like, if there's any sudden movements, but my body also expects there always to be like a sudden movement that's going to hurt me, even though it might not, but my body is like, yeah, tenses up in anticipation of something like that.
Yeah, so common, very normal.
What is the kind of work that you do with people who have maybe more like stigmatized fetishes?
Often people who come to me, and specifically because of their kink and fetish, is because they feel shame about it, because they have been, or they have been shamed by either their partner or society or friends about it. So it's about really looking at where the distress actually really is. And often the distress is not in their kink practices or in their fetish practices. It's about the perception of it and believing that they're somehow they're broken because of misinformation or because of external judgment. Of course, for some kink practices, sometimes the kink practice can be quite extreme. And what I mean by extreme is like on the verge of is it okay or is it harmful? And some people that practice this kind of kink sometimes come to me to figure out whether it's harmful or not harmful, because the threshold between pleasure and pain can be quite confusing sometimes. And again, there's not a lot of good information. The way that we assess it is if there is clear harm to themselves or other people, then that means that might be aware of needing to not stop the kink, but to minimize the harm and to make it part of a safe practice.
And who decides where that line is when something becomes harmful to either themselves or others? Is that something that certain therapists might have like their own preconceived notions about, or is it something that like you figure out together with the client in terms of where they personally feel that line is for them? How does that work?
The line between figuring out if a kink is harmful or not is actually quite a gray area as well, because there is the person practicing its perceived perception of where harm is, and then there is the therapist's perception, and then there's the legal one. So the legal perspective says that if you are being cut or there is blood or there is a strong severe mark left on the body, that is considered harm. And by law, we cannot consent to self-harm, or we cannot consent to harm. So that would be considered illegal in some ways. But of course, a lot of kink practitioners who are doing kinks where there is a bruise left or sometimes a cut disagree with that, because they say that for them it's a pleasure place and they should not be pathologized by the law or pathologized for liking this kind of kink. So the therapist also is going to have to really look into their own moral judgment here to not shame the client further, but at the same time also not encouraging an illegal practice. But also sometimes they can be in disagreement with the client. So then we're left in this gray area when we have to talk about the client's desire maybe, and also giving information to the client about what is considered harm and what is not considered harm. It's having those conversations and staying in the gray area, really. And usually if we stay in the gray area, we help the client figuring out it by themselves in a non-judgmental space, but still with direct conversations about it, clients will sometimes really be able to align their behaviors with what feels right. I think that for what's difficult, but also the best place to be for therapists and clients that practice extreme kink, is to stay in the gray area of keep questioning and keep having some introspection about it, but without encouraging one way or another. And that way it means that the client can really go into their own wisdom and align their own pleasure.
That's such an interesting dynamic. And I'm really curious if there are other themes within therapy that come up for people where you've got these different things at play. You've got the client's perception, the therapist's perception, and then like the legal basis, and then maybe like religious perception. Like how, like other, do you have other examples of when those things are kind of negotiating with each other?
I love the psychosexual field, really, because it is a lot of the time a game of perceptions in some ways. And sometimes it's just really about helping clients really understand what is going on for them. Because in the sexual area, because it's poor sex education, clients will often come to me and ask me to do something for them or to help them with something that is actually quite unrealistic. So for example, if a client comes to me and says, I always want a good direction every single time I have sex, I have to say, well, I'm not going to help you for that because it's just not realistic. So then it's about collaborating on what could be a realistic goal that I think I could help them with. With religion, it's the same thing. Sometimes there's a conflict between clients wanting some sex therapy, but also have some religious belief that can just go against the sex therapy kind of treatment. So a lot of the time in sex therapy, there will be some exercises that incorporate masturbation. But if their religion disagrees with masturbation, then there's a conflict. And so it's about looking at how we can adapt sex therapy that matches their religious beliefs. But at the same time, religious and sex don't always go together. So it's a bit of a compromise and a collaboration as well.